KBOO Community Radio and Peña Flamenca de Portland are proud to co-sponsor Lily Last and Pepe Rafael on Friday, July 25th at 7:30 p.m. Pepe Rafael of Pepe and the Bottle Blondes will team up with Lily Last of Stomptown Flamenco for an evening of flamenco. Again, that's Lily Last and Pepe Rafael on Friday, July 25th at 7:30 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven, located at Southeast 2nd Avenue and Madison Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Lauren Spiro. Lauren is a longtime psychiatric survivor activist. She's diagnosed with chronic undifferentiated schizophrenia at age 17. She has a master's degree in clinical community psychology and 25 years experience working in community mental health agencies. Today, she is the co-director of Emotional CPR. She's the author of the recent book, Living for Two, A Daughter's Journey from Grief and Madness to Forgiveness and Peace. So welcome to Madness Radio, Lauren Spiro.
Oh, thank you, Will, for inviting me on the show.
It's great to have you on the show, Lauren, and congratulations on your new wonderful book, Living for Two. You are an inspiration. Your work as a psychiatric survivor activist on a national and international level has made a huge impact on improving people's lives. So I want to congratulate you on the work that you have done and congratulate you on your new book.
Thank you so much, Will.
Well, let's see, how did you come to write the book? I know you've had a long history both as a therapist and an administrator, but also as a patient in the mental health system, and now as an advocate and a human rights activist. How did you get involved with mental health in general?
The most defining moment of my life happened when I was 14 and my father was 47. So my father was shot in the face by a teenager with a handgun and never regained consciousness and passed away 16 days later. And the world as I knew it ended that day, May 28th, 1971. So about 10 years ago, as I approached my 47th birthday, I just felt a wind or the spirit kind of beckoning me to just stop, to stop and notice the impact that my father's life and death had had on my life, just how my life had been impacted by that devastating experience. So I went to where he was shot in Washington, D.C., for example. I went to my childhood home.
So this and this happened when you were 14, just a young teenager. What was it that happened? Was it really, was it a robbery or a random kind of senseless violence? Or what was it that happened?
At the time, we were told that there were five eyewitnesses. So I went to where he was shot on the anniversary of, you know, the moment he was shot. It was 1:30 in the afternoon. And I spent some time there, and I talked to someone who was with him shortly minutes before he was shot. And it was, as you can imagine, it was a very emotional time. When I got home that day, that afternoon, a friend of mine, Joel, had downloaded five newspaper articles about the day that it really informed me more about what had happened, because I didn't go to the trial. Some of my father's friends did, but you know, again, I was 14, so I just didn't quite remember details. I don't think they told me details at the time, but so There is actually a one of the newspaper articles. I was particularly moved by it, and it's in the book. The lead witness for the prosecution was a 16-year-old girl. And so she testified about what happened, and basically the judge dropped the robbery charges, and they were found guilty. It was a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old were found guilty of second degree, so unpremeditated murder. So it seemed like they wanted him to maybe purchase a gun that they were selling, or it's not clear, but he pushed them down and he ran. And that I did know many years prior to the book. But so as he was running, he turned around to look, you know, to see if they were following him. And it was at that moment that they shot him in the face.
So these were just strangers on the street who approached him.
Absolutely. I mean, there's more detail in the book, but it was he was in the insurance business and he was collecting premiums that day. So he had knocked on the door of this particular home and told the young woman that her mother said to come by so he could get the check. And her mother wasn't there, so he left and he walked away. And so the two teenagers that were found guilty of killing him were in the house at the time. And so they immediately followed him and then approached him. And there was a tussle. The newspaper article talks about a tussle. So it's not really clear what happened.
So as a 14-year-old girl, just one day your father is away at work. And then the next thing you know, you hear that he's in the hospital and he's been shot.
Yeah. I mean, it was my first experience with having difficulty or just actually not being able to believe reality. I don't talk about this in the book, but he was the only person in my family that I liked and I felt some safety with him. But he was in intensive care. Well, he was in intensive care the whole 16 days, but his first 3 days in intensive care, his face was completely covered in bandages. So I still couldn't tell it was him. And so I waited for him to just come through the door, you know, just waited for him to, when he was in surgery, he had about 8 hours of emergency brain surgery. We got there probably 6 hours into the 8-hour brain surgery. But, you know, I just remember thinking, oh, he's going to just walk through the door and say, oh, it's been a terrible mistake. Let's go home. You know, so I was 14 and I could not believe, I'm going to get emotional, I just couldn't believe that it was happening. It was very painful. So it, you know, it was the most painful time of my life, that time from 14 to 17, because 18 months after his murder, I was put in a mental institution and labeled with schizophrenia. And, you know, it's like, gee, I don't know that anyone put those pieces together very well.
They weren't really thinking that the experiences that they were calling schizophrenia actually were directly resulting from this trauma, even though you just said that separating yourself from reality was one of the ways that you responded to this horrific thing that happened.
It was just, yeah, I struggled with, you know, again, I was 14 and a half, so I did struggle with believing it. But eventually, he was in the coma for 16 days. So, you know, the fourth day, the bandage came off, and I came to understand that this was really happening. But it was extremely stressful and difficult. But in any case, you know, life went on. So I was in ninth grade when it happened. It was in May, so summer vacation. I went back to school. You know, I just continued living, you know, getting back into the routine of day-to-day living, you know, learning how to put one foot in front of the other and doing reasonably well, I suppose. And on my 16th birthday, it was wonderful. I actually climbed a mountain and fell in love on top of the mountain, and I was feeling really good. And one evening I felt a presence. I basically felt like God chose me for a task that meant risking my life. I was trying to, you know, thoughts started racing and every cell in my body was alive and I was trying to understand what was going on. I was in love and things were confusing, but suddenly I felt God had chosen me.
So you felt this presence of God. How did you know? Was it something in your body? Were you hearing something, or were you alone when this happened? Or
I had been spending a lot of time alone around my 16th birthday and soon afterwards. My mother was, you know, a 40-year-old widow. In fact, she had a boyfriend, so her attention was really on other things. But this one evening before I went into the mental institution, I just, for the first time in my life, felt a very deep spiritual connection. I didn't grow up particularly practicing any religion. With my father's brutal murder, I thought, if there was a God, I don't believe in him, because the pain was too great. So I had really disconnected from any belief in a God. But this particular night before I was put in the hospital, God came at me full force, and I could feel, you know, racing thoughts. I had what was labeled delusions and hallucinations. You know, suddenly I felt chosen by God or a higher power to clean up the streets of murderers and drug dealers. And I felt like I needed to, you know, get to the President Nixon at the time, so I could be part of community building and making the streets safer. And just was overwhelmed with, really what it came down to was being overwhelmed with feeling oneness with the universe. And at the time, I didn't have resource to navigate that space.
What was the response of the people around you? Did you talk with your mother about this, what was happening? Were you very excited and talking really fast and your personality had changed? Or what happened after you had this presence of God come to you?
This presence came very suddenly. It was basically within a 3-hour time period, because I remember that evening. The intensity was just increasing and increasing and increasing. And finally, I said, okay, I need to go home, because I had been walking around the neighborhood. And I went home and I told my mother that I needed to get to the president so that I could help him understand the need to clean up the streets from the violence, from the drug dealers, and maybe my story of my father's murder would help. And so the next morning, she took me to see a psychiatrist, and he said, go directly to the hospital. So I went directly to at that point, it was just the general hospital, and was admitted immediately to the psych unit. So what had been exciting, you know, I was in love for the first time in my life at 16. I mean, if you don't know love, you don't know what you're missing. And all of a sudden I'm hit with this. I'm head over heels. My body's becoming alive and I'm excited but anxious. So this great energy suddenly became very dark and very scary when I was admitted to the mental institution, because they put me on, you know, antipsychotics and I was locked up and I couldn't go outside. And so it became very scary. And I was mostly with adults, many of whom were getting electroshock treatment. So it was pretty terrifying.
So you were feeling really happy, you were feeling positive, and you weren't frightened or anything. It was really the people around you that became frightened.
Absolutely. I mean, I was feeling really good. I was feeling powerful for the first time in my life. I felt this incredible oneness with the universe, with people, with plants, with animals. I was overwhelming with this extraordinary sense of awareness and being. And absolutely, people around me, particularly, well, my mother and then people in the mental institution, I don't think they had a clue.
So you weren't doing anything dangerous or self-destructive or talking about suicidal feelings or anything?
Not at that point, not at the point when I was admitted to the mental institution. I think because I was put in seclusion after about 2 months or so. And I remember thinking I must have said something that led them to putting me in there. So I was just struggling. They were putting me on higher and higher doses of antipsychotics, Stelazine, Thorazine at the time, and Melaril. Nothing was working. So the doses were getting higher and higher, and I lost my vision. Basically, I couldn't read because my vision was so blurry. And so I think I must have said something about how difficult it was and I was struggling that led them to put me in the seclusion room. I did not trust the authorities, okay? When I first went into the hospital, I decided to share with a staff person a little bit about what was going on with me, that I was in communication with God. God was speaking to me, and sometimes through the radio or through the TV. And I thought, let me share just a little bit and see the reaction. So I told this one psych tech a little bit about what was going on. She immediately mentioned it to another psych tech, and both of them were laughing at me.
Wow.
And I felt so humiliated that I decided I couldn't trust any of these authority figures, you know, that were in the mental institution. And I became quite silent. I think they could see that I was struggling. I was absolutely in an incredible, the worst nightmare I could imagine, you know, in anyone's life. Basically, the message from God to me was that I was asked to do a task, and doing it meant risking my life. But when God asks you to do a task, it's not like you say, sorry, no thanks, find somebody else. And for me, being put in a mental institution, locked up, high doses of antipsychotics, was part of the test I needed to get through to accomplish my goal. So I just wanted to get out of there. I was trying to play the game. And I probably told them I felt like my head was going to burst. I was processing unimaginable amounts of information. It's like every movement, every smile, everything that happened. If someone yawned next to me, everything meant something. And it was overwhelming. It could have brought disaster. It could have meant that my mother would die instantly in a car accident. I couldn't filter out all the stimulation that was coming at me. So my mind was racing. I wasn't sleeping very much. The sleeping medication they gave me helped because, hey, I needed to sleep. But it was hard to sleep with my mind racing. And then I would get headaches, which I never get headaches, but I got headaches at 16 when I was locked up. So I think this culmination of what they were seeing led to them putting me back in the seclusion room. This was a very terrifying time of my life. One thing I saw that I just hardly have words for it was I saw someone, I was walking by the door when someone was getting shock treatment. So when I happened to walk by and the door was open because staff were walking, they were like exiting or entering. So I saw this man's body elevated off the gurney, because at that moment he was receiving his voltage. So it was really, really scary.
Must have been horrifying for a 17-year-old girl who's alone in there with all these adults to be seeing these things happening.
It was absolutely the most horrifying thing I could imagine. I prayed that I wasn't going to be on that gurney tied down like that man was. So most of the other patients in the mental institution were adults. I was the youngest person by far. I was fighting for my life, and I didn't trust the staff because previously they had laughed at me and I felt humiliated. I felt like I was on a conveyor belt. The psychiatrist would come in and ask me, you know, how are you? And with a team of people, and then disappear. So I thought, okay, you know, he's just going through the motions. He's well-intended. He's doing his job. But they don't know what's going on with me. And they're not even asking. I tell people today, and I absolutely believe this is true, that if someone had believed in me and had believed in my mind at the time of this breakthrough, you know, what they labeled as a nervous breakdown, but I came 25 years later to label as a spiritual breakthrough, if they had said, why did God choose you? Why now? How does it feel? If they had just believed in me, then that could have helped me go from monologue, where I was stuck, you know, into a dialogue. But that didn't happen.
No one ever asked you about that. Why are you chosen, or to talk about your experience more?
No one ever asked anything about it.
Did anybody ever talk with you or ask you about the connection between this experience you were going through and your father's death?
No, I don't recall anyone ever asking me about it. And I found that confusing, because why wouldn't they try and talk with me about it? He was just brutally murdered 16 months, a year and a half earlier, you know, and they didn't talk to me about it.
What were they saying was the reason that you had schizophrenia?
You know, I don't recall them explaining a reason, but they did tell my mother and myself that I would be in the mental institution pretty much all of my life, that I needed to be on psychiatric drugs all my life, and basically there was no chance of really having a normal life outside of the hospital. And I couldn't really take that in. It was very frightening, but I think part of me didn't believe them. And actually, years later, my mother told me that she never believed them.
So, Lauren, how did you end up finally getting out of the hospital?
After 6 or 7 months of this racing thoughts, they started to quiet down. And I thought that I was just doing what society wanted me to do, you know, to suppress what was labeled madness. So I'm sure I became more compliant.
And you had been medicated that whole time with antipsychotic medications?
Yes, absolutely.
And did you continue to take the medications when you came out of the hospital, or?
No, I never wanted to be on the medications. There were a few times that I spit them out and then they put me on the liquid medication, but I never liked putting chemicals in my body. So no, I stopped as soon as I got out. And for the next 20 years, I would say I was on and off psychiatric medication, mostly off, but I tried to, you know, not take it if I didn't need it. I think there were times. I remember the last time that I went on psychiatric medication, I was feeling depressed and I didn't understand why I was depressed. And so I took medication for about 3 weeks, and that was all that was needed as far as I was concerned. And that was the last time I ever took psych meds. And that was about 20 years ago.
And part of this too for you has been going back and reclaiming some of the spiritual experience that you went through. I mean, you were basically taught that this idea that you had a special destiny and a mission, and that it was your job to try and change the world, that all this was a symptom of mental illness. And now you said you described that more as a spiritual breakthrough. Tell us about how you made that transition and how you see that spiritual aspect of what you went through today.
I'm looking for the words, because sometimes words don't come to me very easily. I'd rather dance it or paint it. It became very clear to me over decades that what was labeled as madness was in fact a vision. And that miraculously enough, amazingly enough, at 16, I think my mind was holding out for me what my spirit wanted my life to become about. And of course, I didn't recognize it at the time, and no one recognized it at the time. But, you know, the visions I had at 16 are basically what I'm doing today. So my job today with the National Coalition for Mental Health Recovery is about reaching the president. And we are reaching the president. We are in meetings at the White House discussing policy. So it's only in hindsight I look back and say, wow, was that possible that at 16 that I had this vision that now is coming true? And the answer for me is that yes, that dreams do come true, that visions do come true. And my life, for me anyway, is a testament to that.
Beautiful.
Today, my work is far beyond trying to change the mental health system. I'm getting very bold in my courage. So I will say that I do want to change the world. I mean, who doesn't? Who doesn't want a peaceful world, a loving world? So part of my journey was about 5.5 years ago, we, Dan Fisher and myself, we created emotional CPR, which teaches people how to assist and support others through an emotional crisis.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what emotional CPR is and how it works?
Many of us are familiar with CPR, which helps people through a cardiac crisis. So ECPR was to help people through an emotional crisis. So CPR, the C represents connecting. The P represents empowerment, and the R represents revitalization. So consistent with my experience and the experience of, gosh, hundreds if not thousands of people I know who went through emotional crisis, when I was in crisis, I was stuck in monologue. And so having someone listen very deeply is about connecting. It's about believing in the person. It's about being there for the person. So when I feel that someone is there for me and listening, I feel connected and I'm able to tap into my power and remember that I have agency. I can make decisions. So that's the empowerment piece of it. That when we know someone's there, some caring person is right there by our side supporting us, we can move into, you know, feeling connected and then move into feeling empowered. And then as we feel empowered and we're getting more comfortable with, yes, I can think well, I can make decisions, then we move into that. I think of it as the life force, the chi is about revitalization, that I'm then able to go back into community and perhaps change, perhaps not change. Routines, roles, relationships, but it's getting back into that flow of life. Emotional CPR is actually primary prevention, which is the most cost-effective form of healthcare. So when, if we learn ECPR as a culture, like we've learned CPR, then we can support people and prevent the individual going into crisis. So when people feel supported, when they feel like they have a place to go that's safe, whether it's an individual or a community center or wherever it is, a family, we can prevent the emotions from escalating and getting bigger and then overflowing into crisis. So it's very different in that sense, in that it's primary prevention. But if we come in a little bit later and the person is in crisis, then it is a way to basically connect and de-escalate.
Tell us about your own process of learning and discovering around the tragedy with the murder of your father and what you've learned now looking back on that.
Part of my healing was understanding my own white racism. I didn't agree to be racist. It was installed from the outside. And it left me damaged, as in the case with all people in oppressor roles. So how could I forgive James and William for killing my father? How could I not? So coming to understand the fragility of humanity and of myself, using my own life as my best model, I've just learned a lot about forgiveness.
So Lauren, we are just about out of time. So remind us about the title of your book and how people can get a copy and how they can get in touch with you.
The book is Living for Two, A Daughter's Journey from Grief and Madness to Forgiveness and Peace. And it's published by Trafford. My website is www.laurenspiro.com, LaurenSpiro.com.
Lauren Spiro, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with Lauren Spiro. She's a longtime psychiatric survivor activist who's diagnosed with chronic undifferentiated schizophrenia at age 17. She has a master's degree in clinical community psychology. Lauren is the author of the recent book, Living for Two, A Daughter's Journey from Grief and Madness to Forgiveness and Peace. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. It's 1 o'clock and it's time. Nope, it's 12 o'clock and it's time now for headline news.
And now the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, July 7th. 110 Palestinians have been kidnapped overnight by Israeli police. Around half of them are children, during protests that swept across Arab towns in Palestine. Protests have been spurred by the brutal murder of 16-year-old Palestinian Mohammed Abdu Qadir in Jerusalem last week. Protesters blocked roads and carried Palestinian flags in an attempt to prevent Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from declaring comprehensive war on Gaza. Detroit is cutting off water to approximately 3,000 customers per week who are delinquent on their water bills. Many bills are less than a few hundred dollars. UN officials have condemned Detroit's actions as they believe access to water and sanitation is a human right. The Detroit Water and Sewage Department estimates that 50% of their accounts are past due. However, many corporate and institutional water bills are delinquent, but services of those institutions are not being shut off. Palmer Park Golf Club and the Veterans Administration Hospital are said to owe more than $200,000 each. The Detroit Red Wings hockey rink, Eastern Market, and Ford Field Stadium reportedly owe more than $55,000 each. Many believe this is an attempt to make the water department more attractive as an investment for privatization. Unions around the country are aligning themselves with the climate movement and backing the historic People's